CO2 levels. And we've also been involved with an outreach project to ocean acidification that I won't have much time to speak about today. I'll just mention it now and in the summary. But in terms of our approach, in the center-wide work, and our point of contact for the Northeast Center OA program is Beth Phelan. With the Royal We, have been involved in local to regional monitoring, in evaluation of mechanisms through experimentation, and modeling of species and ecosystem response to high CO2. But again, our work is primarily deals with the experimental analysis, and here I define mechanistic approach is using experimentation as a means to identify and quantify effects tailored to the current state of the knowledge on this topic. So we can think about the progression of knowledge. Let's start with to the far left, this blue circle. You think of that as a zero, where you know very little about a topic. In this case, it's not too far from the truth regarding the middle part of the last decade with regards to OA effects on marine fishes. And the progression of knowledge generally follows such that the first focus is on an experimental approach is to demonstrate effects occur. Once that's been established, or in some cases, if the organism and the logistics permitted, concurrent with the demonstration of effects, one might be able to identify the possible consequences of the effects that are observed. And lastly, in this progression, is the step we'd all like to be at with any topic, and that is determine the likelihood of occurrence of these effects and their consequences. But in reality, most of the work on ocean acidification at this point, in terms of the experimental context, regarding marine fish, is about testing for and demonstrating effects of high CO2 on response variables. So in order to approach this in a rational way, and I think the work in the large is very exciting. Again, it gives experimental ecologists a chance to approach a problem in a strategic and systematic way, where we have to identify the proper scope of treatments, given that we know very little in any particular case. You know, often one might be studying a species for which it has not been used as a subject in OA studies to date. So at that point, we know very little. The scope of treatments has to be used in a way, selected in a way that makes sense in the local context, as does the choice of species. I'll get back to both of these in a minute, as well as the response variables that are sensitive to and important to the organism that's the subject of the experimental work. So the way we're approaching the experimental design in this sequence is our first type of experiments that we do are these single factor, one way ANOVA approaches, a step one experiments in which we have multiple CO2 levels and measure a response. We actually measure multiple responses, but in this case, in the schematic, what we see is a response, say it's survival, goes from high to low as CO2 increases. The next step is to run a concurrent analysis of the second treatment, or a two-way ANOVA in this case, where I plotted here CO2 versus temperature. The other variable could be contaminants, low DO, whatever the particular stressor of importance is to your system. And these responses I'm showing, again, are hypothetical. But in this case, we have a response. There's a rapid change, a steep gradient in the high CO2, low temperature part of the space. And then the third step, once you identify where those gradient responses are steepest, step three experiments are a refined two-way in which the experimental grid is restricted to that area where all the action is happening. And to date, we've conducted studies in step one. We have two studies on step two that we've done in our laboratory, and I'll be referring to those later, but focusing primarily on one of our first experiments, the step one experiment. In terms of the implementation, we chose to, by strategy, to use a wide range of CO2 levels, one closest to our ambient conditions, an intermediate level, and the highest level is such that if you see no effect at this high level, then chances are this particular species or this life stage of the species and the responses that you're measuring are robust to the high CO2 that you're challenging it with. Our particular system is designed to be used for the step two and three experiments in that we have up to five different CO2 treatments that we could implement, and the containers, which are these stacks here, the containers along this schematic are different temperature baths in which we have egg and larval containers. So in principle, this could be a 5x5 analysis, but any of you who do this kind of work know that that's almost insane to attempt a 25 treatment combination experiment replicated at least two or three times. So we've done subsets of this design. Let me show you some pictures of what they actually looks like. And we have all of our pre-treatment, water treatment, and up at this mezzanine level in one of our laboratories, a 16-foot high ceiling, which comes in very handy in this case. The treatment water is brought down into these columns, and there's a counter current of CO2 going up the columns, and that's how we obtained our up to as many as four different CO2 treatment levels that we've used to date. And this water then is pumped into our rearing container, which is shown here under the hood. Each one of these polycarbonate containers has an inflow-outflow, lidded, covered in this tarp, and the other side of the white tarp is black tarp, so it's a black contrast background. And this holds up to 13 containers in any one temperature bath. Looking down into one of those containers, these polycarbonate containers, the 16 liters, we see the inflow underwater here, a double-headed outflow, screened outflow. And this happens to be an early stage. You're getting ready for the first stage of the experiment. So this actually is a floating, well, it's a coffee filter. You can recognize that. But a floating basket that we use to contain and hold the eggs that we monitor to hatch, you know, count, release, or photograph, depending on what the protocol calls for. And the larvae are reared in this 12-liter volume part of the container. In terms of our organisms, to date, at our laboratory, we've worked with two species. Both of them are flatfish, but they're interesting in that they have a very different life history. Summer flounder spawns in the autumn in warmer water, around 19 to 13 degrees, as it's moving offshore out of the bays. The yellow dot shows a representation of where our laboratory is located. The eggs and larvae, the eggs are pelagic. They're up in the water column on the shelf. And the larvae are also experiencing shelf water in the ingress back inshore, either late in the autumn or the following spring, depending on when the adults spawn, the eggs release, and the temperature experienced by offspring. Winter flounder, in contrast, different family, bright-eyed flatfish, different trophic niche, if you will, as well. But it spawns in the wintertime inshores in estuarine situations. It has benthic eggs that experience the interface between the mud and the bay water. And colleagues of ours, as well as we're doing work with black sea bass, the colleagues at Milford Laboratory are the primary focus for our work on black sea bass, which again is a different life history altogether than the other two flatfish, in that it spawns in midsummer warm waters, pelagic eggs, and inhabits eggs and larvae inhabit shelf water. In terms of the response variables of interest, certainly we're interested in those that are important to the fish. We can call them fitness components. Some of them are direct measures of survival and mortality. Others are growth, condition, and so on. And we show a list of those here, the variable type from gamete viability, scored as fertilization rate. That work has been done in our laboratory, and this table reads out the various response variables that we and colleagues are interested in quantifying in these studies. And our experiments so far have been in various durations. We've had done some two studies now on both summer and winter flounder on gamete effects or responses to high CO2 scored by fertilization rates. A very short-term, a few minute exposure, then determination of viability over the next day or two after that. Some of our work has been, the red arrows, by the way, reflect how long the organism is experiencing the CO2 treatment. Some experience CO2 treatment shortly after fertilization or at fertilization in some cases through hatching and perhaps pre-feeding larvae until starvation in some of our studies. And then others take this through the entire, almost the entire larval period for the flatfishes. Today I'll be talking about two experiments that have these two durations, the pre-feeding the embryo and yolk sac larvae as well as the feeding larvae. In our particular implementation of the experiment I'll talk about now, summer flounder was subjected to three different CO2 treatment levels, which reflect, again, local ambient, a double or two and a half times multiplier of that, and a high, which is about five or six times our local ambient. And by the way, our local ambient in the autumn when these fish spawn can be as high as around mid-700s part per million. Here's a track of the actual pH treatment levels, CO2 was the treatment level, but the pH as a consequence of those CO2 levels across the month-long experiment. So roughly 7.75 is our ambient pH, 7.4 and 7.1 to 7.2 is our lowest pH treatment we use in this case. Protocol pretty straightforward, collecting eggs in the inshore in the summertime. Adults are held anywhere between 3 months to a year and 3 months. They've been in the laboratory for a while before they're used. Strip spawn, assess egg viability, stock the egg baskets, larvae hatch out, score them, and rear a subset of the eggs to hatch out. And the response variables in this study include, in summer flounder at least, these five responses, but today I'll just be talking about the three in red: embryo survival, larval ontogeny, that is growth and development, and some histopathology results in terms of the adult, or sorry, the late larval organ, soft tissue organ features that are affected by the CO2 levels. Okay, so what have we found out? And our first result in terms of the survival of summer flounder through the embryonic period, it showed a dramatic decrease in survival across the CO2 levels. Here's the parts per, the microatmosphere CO2 level of our three treatments. Here are the pHs associated with them. And what I'm scoring here is relative survival to hatching. We used three female sources for our eggs and kept those female sources or those female sib groups separate in case they were different in their egg quality. And indeed they were. Subgroup 1, for instance, had a lower survival at ambient conditions of about 30%. Subgroups 2 and 3 are right about 70% in terms of their survival under ambient conditions. So we're glad we didn't pool them into replicates and split them out and allocate them to replicates in the traditional way. But in all three cases, once we convert mortality or survival to relative survival, i.e. each subgroup starts at 100% at the low level, there was about a 50% decline in survival at the intermediate level and another 50 or more percent decline in the survival by the highest treatment level to hatching. And these data, as well as other data I'm going to show you in the next few slides, will appear in a paper in Biogeosciences that's in press. In terms of the effects of high CO2 and summer flounder size and development, and we're talking larvae in this case, we sampled and photographed larvae on a weekly basis in this particular experiment. These are day zero larvae with a variety of the morphometric measurements we take in terms of body length, body depths, yolk sac length and depth, oil globule size, and clearly by day 28 the larva looks quite a bit different. This is right in the verge of a metamorphosis. We still take the same lengths and body depths, but now we include jaw length. And also a feature that is a reflection of developmental status, and that's the angle of the notochord from the straight line of the midline, and that's called the flexion angle that we scored. So we had 6 to 8 response variables that we scored in each of our weekly samples through day 28 when the experiment was terminated. Here I'm showing a principal component analysis results for day 28 larvae only, just to give you a sense of the collinearity of these responses. You know, clearly we'd expect lengths to be correlated with each other, and indeed they are: standard length, fork length, the body length, total length, mandible length, and depth at fin fold, and depth of muscular mass at right at the event. The variable that contributed most to the second principal component is the one that goes up a bit north-south here, and that's flexion angle. So this is telling us something different about the organism than these do. So these are, we refer to these primarily as size indicators. The fish get bigger or smaller depending on the treatment effect. And this is a developmental rate indicator in terms of how we score. And these are the only two axes, PC1 and 2, that were significant. And we subjected these two axes to a MANOVA or ANOVA, depending on the particular hypothesis of interest. All right, here's what we found out. This plot shows the effect of CO2 on size and development for each of the four, here in this case I'm showing three of our sample days. Day 0, i.e. at hatching, 14, which is halfway through our experimental period, and two plots for day 28, which is our terminus. The first three, A, B, and C, plot PC1 score. So this is the size of the fish as a function of the CO2 treatment level it was exposed to. And I'm showing also in the embedded information is the weighting of the principal component, the loading on that particular response, the original response, like in this case body length, standard length, total length, the depths, yolk length, yolk depth, oil globule size. And there is a negative sign here, so that they're responding differently than the length responses that we measured. But the upshot is that early in life, at hatching, the animals at the ambient CO2 are smaller than those at the intermediate high CO2. And these results are significant even between the low and intermediate level. Similarly, the low CO2 level at halfway through the larval period, roughly, in this case at this temperature, is at 19.5 degrees C, is still significantly smaller than the intermediate and the high CO2 level. And by day 28, things start to change. And the plot here, C, shows the PC1 again, which is, again, the size variable. And it shows that the high CO2 level animals actually are no longer the largest. The largest ones are in the intermediate level. And the low CO2 level groups are actually still smaller and not significantly different than the high, by the way. But because we took a multivariate approach and measured a quantity that also reflected development, this pattern is not just simply a size change. It's revealed through this analysis of the PC2 response. This is the one, again, where flexion angle is the big loaded, had the heavy, large loading on PC2, so with that developmental axis that I referred to before. And what we find is, the way the PCA works, by the way, the plus and minus, whether you have a negative sign or a positive sign is irrelevant. It's a trend we're really most interested in. The high CO2 group that was here in terms of size actually has the largest flexion angle. It's the most developmentally advanced, more so than the intermediate and the low CO2 treatment level. So these larvae, when exposed to high CO2 levels, are growing more quickly, developing more quickly in terms of the biology of the organism. As I mentioned to you before, this species spawns in the autumn, and depending on when the female spawns, the larvae may reach a competency for metamorphosis before winter. At 8 degrees C and below, they cannot metamorphose. So they possibly can ingress to the bays before winter, or they get stuck in the offshore habitat as water temperatures go near or below 8 degrees. So the low CO2 treatment animals actually are going to have a different timing of their ingress, quite likely. And this could have consequences, of course, in terms of the relative mortality of inshore habitats versus offshore habitats in the winter and so on. But this is another example of where the likelihood and consequences questions would be the next steps of this kind of study. A colleague at Rutgers, Keith Cooper, and his grad student have been doing the histopathology for us. And here's I won't show the actual tissue slides, but there is an effect at high CO2 levels. But we did a similar morphometric analysis of the facial cartilage and skeletal elements, mandible, lower jaw, upper jaw, and snout, and subjected these five variables and total length also to a PCA. And there is one significant principal component, all reflect size, they're all scored about 0.95 and above. And we see a similar kind of pattern, whereas the it's not as clear as with the size alone, but the lowest CO2 level, highest pH group is a solid line, and you see the animal actually has a large, what's happening at this stage, by the way, is the face is being compressed and remodeled due to metamorphosis. So this reflects what we saw in the last images. The intermediate and high level CO2 in animals actually have shorter faces, if you will, during this craniofacial remodeling of metamorphosis. So this reflects the results we saw in the external body size measurements. In terms of what's next, we have performed and are now analyzing two of these step two experiments, these two-way experiments where we cross CO2 and water temperature in a 3x3 and a 3x4 design, with the 3 and 4 being the CO2 treatment levels, summer flounder and winter flounder. And those response variable sets have been expanded to include fertilization rates, condition scored through RNA-DNA ratios, and gene expression, again with our collaborator at Rutgers. We're going back and adding information to our meta-analysis with publication since last June. There's now about 50 or we had 32 publications we assessed last summer. Again, like I said before, 14 qualified for our meta-analysis. 40 of experiments were included in those 14. And we're expanding our criteria for inclusion in these tests. The original criterion only included studies in which the pH dropped no more than 0.5 units below ambient. We had other criteria as well, but we're doing a stepped expansion of those inclusion criteria. And as I said a while ago at the start, we are building our ocean acidification outreach effort. We've had several students working with us over the last summers, a new one this summer as well. We're developing materials for in-house and off-site use, both for tours, in-house, open houses, as well as our visiting of local schools. We're coordinating with our neighbor here at the Sandy Hook campus, the Sea Grant, New Jersey Sea Grant, to provide public education unit for OA. And they, as well as STEM High School at our campus, has a teacher workshop in the summer. So we're getting the word out through teaching the teachers, as well as interfacing directly with the students. In terms of the, in a nutshell, request by the organizers of this effort, the NECAN, I'll say that we have developed a strategic experimental plan, have implemented it in a way that cast what we thought and still think is a broad, defensible, inferential net. The plan covers a large portion of the environmental experimental space for these species with regards to CO2, temperature, and we have some plans in the works to do some dissolved oxygen work and some contaminant work as well on other species. Two, we've targeted species of import to the area, both recreationally and commercially important, and also ecologically important, and they have diverse ecologies and life histories that have provide, I think, some insights into which species may be more at risk to higher CO2 levels. And third, we've measured responses with the intent of capturing these subtle yet important effects, because as I said in my abstract, I believe, few conclusions can be drawn at this point about responses of fish, other than we can expect the effects of CO2 to be subtle, species and life stage specific, and potentially to interact with other stressors. So we're trying to illuminate some of the patterns that are being emerging from our work through using diverse life histories and also literature work. So the initial results from the summer flounder experiment, the one-way CO2 treatment, showed embryonic period mortality, body size, and developmental rate all to increase with increasing CO2 concentrations. But the pattern, the trajectory, this ontogenic trajectory is not as simple as simply that. The ecology of this organism, summer flounder, may indeed be impacted by the consequence of this rapid ontogenic rate in terms of changing its habitat use as a late larva or early juvenile and its recruitment to the inshore habitat in nature, either before or after winter. And thirdly, our analysis of a small but growing worldwide literature on CO2 effects in early life stages shows there are significant repeatable and statistically significant responses across all taxonomic groups. But some of our hypotheses show that the egg habitat, as well as the otolith size, had a taxonomic and life history bias. And as I pointed out in my introduction of that data set, there's clearly, just due to the fact of who's working on these studies, OA studies, there's a geographic and taxonomic bias in the published studies. And, it's good, not much we can do about that, but it's good to know that exists. And lastly, I want to just thank my group members, full-time staff, summer students, postdocs, technicians, and federal employees. So with that, I'll say thanks for your attention. Of course, I heard no feedback yet, and I'd be glad to answer questions if there's time.
Thank you very much, Chris. That was a great talk. It looks like slightly warmer weather in that slide.
Yeah, late summer.
Okay, I've got a few questions here. The first one is from Todd Katzen. Have you conducted any experiments to assess the impacts of the variable aragonite saturation state?
Well, we've calculated that. We have preserved otoliths for evaluating the morphometrics of otoliths. So that would be how we would have some insight into that. The calculation, of course, is a derived calculation through based on the water chemistry variables that we collect. And the otolith work is still to be done. So yes, in terms of intent, don't have any results yet on that. And we do have the otolith material for all three experiments, the one-way summer flounder and the two ways for both summer and winter flounder.
Great, thank you. Another question from Helmut Thomas. Dear Chris, thank you for the great talk. Question, what do the high CO2 levels relate to or stand for? Is it atmospheric CO2 or organic matter decomposition on the sediment surface?
Yeah. Atmospheric or CO2, microatmospheres, based on the calculation. I can't recall the program name. Dan Wazurik would have that, but through his calculations from his water chemistry parameters, he was able to derive the various water chemistry variables. But it is the 4700. It is the water PCO2 microatmospheres.
Thank you. Another question here from Timothy Bowden. Great talk. What genes are you planning on looking at?
What are we planning on looking at, Rue?
What genes are you planning
genes,
on looking
yeah,
at?
Yeah. Yeah, that work is just getting underway. Our colleague at Rutgers, Keith Cooper, has been looking at four or five genes in addition to, in terms of the process, he gives us the RNA-DNA ratio, which is a traditional metric in larval fish ecology for condition, but he has identified genes that are a precursor or indicative of the formulation of bones. So he has his set. I could forward that list to him if he's interested. If he could drop me an email, I'll be glad to share that with him.
Great. Another question from Ron Huber. What are the impacts of ocean acidification on prey of age zero flounder, especially winter flounder?
Yeah, well, that's something to investigate. I cannot say. There's been, as far as I know, nothing done on the prey for either of these species. You know, zooplankton for the early the larvae of both species, or the benthic invertebrates for and associated invertebrates to the benthos for the winter flounder juveniles.
Thank you. A question here from Dwight Gledhill. Have you explored adapting the facility to adopt a PCO2 level lower than ambient, e.g. pre-industrial?
Yeah, Dwight, yeah, I didn't spend much time on that at all. I will say that, again, Dan Wazurik, if you still have the picture on the screen, that's Dan with the beard on the far right leaning back and looking at the camera. Dan and his assistants, DeMond, is back in the back of the room, as well as Matt Poach, are the three chemists working on this. But Dan's been primarily the lead on the system development. There's been an evolution of our system, our actual experimental system. The results I've been presenting here on summer flounder are our first generation system, if you will, in terms of the complete experiment. It's been modified, I believe, maybe Dan would say 1.5 times since then, by specifically both stripping CO2 out of the air that we use to treat the water prior to the CO2 infusion, and two, through a membrane contactor that allows us to lower the CO2 levels of the water. Our current experiments that we just wrapped up, the two-way on summer flounder, for instance, we had four CO2 levels that resulted in pH levels of around 8, a little bit before above 8, down to around 7.6, 7.5, something in that neighborhood. I can't give you the CO2 levels, but they're correspondingly lower. Dwight, I don't believe we reached pre-industrial levels, but we certainly were able to scale down our CO2 treatment levels to a range that we're happier with.
Great. Well, at the moment, I think I've asked all the questions that have been put to us online. I'm just going to give it a little bit longer and see if anybody else has a last-minute question. That was a great talk, Chris, so thank you very much. I'm not seeing anything else come in, so I will press the button to stop recording and say thank you to all of you for your time today and for joining us. Oh, hang on, we've got one more question. It's from Ron Huber again, about chronic land-based coastal acid sources and winter flounder. Superphosphate fertilizer equals one of the most manufactured compounds on Earth, 5 tons of highly acidic waste per ton of fertilizer. We have an eroding fertilizer waste bank beach with average pH less than 2, continually migrating into intertidal flats. I'm not quite sure what the question is there, but it sounds like a pretty serious.
Well, it does. That's really interesting information. But if you could, I'm not sure if the questions appear in a written form or on just the audio of this, Rue, but I'd be glad to, if you could send me an email with regards to that information and reference, I'd be glad to see it. Because certainly, you know, inshore habitats are much more, variable, including a higher mean CO2 level, but at both seasonal as well as diurnal fluctuations that aren't seen in the open ocean. So we're certainly interested in hearing examples of that, any kind of data that exists to document that.
Okay, well, so Ron, if you can hear, send Chris an email. If that doesn't happen, Chris, then let us know, and we'll provide email contacts and everything else like that. And I think Ron's question, he just clarified it, was can coastal acid waste be factored in along with atmospheric?
I think the first step is knowledge of that, to provide the context in terms of the, again, location variance in that, as well as the magnitude of the CO2 or the pH, the acidity of the water where these animals inhabit. Because many of these species, winter flounder is a good example, it spawns in waters that are, you know, several meters deep. And the eggs stay put. They're not only demersal in terms of sinking, but they are adhesive, so they aren't dislodged easily from the area. So they stay in these shallow waters, which may be challenging in many ways. Which, by the way, you know, for everyone, you know, probably came to the same conclusion. Perhaps these animals, obviously before industrial times, have adapted to these kinds of highly variable, but naturally variable conditions of temperatures, as well as salinity, CO2, and so on. But it's only been aggravated, and maybe it's pushed them behind their ability to respond by the industrialization of these coastlines where winter flounders spawn and where their early life stages inhabit.
And Ron says he's going to send you the details. So that's
great. Thanks, Ron.
Okay, I think that's it. So thank you all very much for taking the time to join us today. Thank you very much, Chris, for taking the time to give us this great presentation. Cassie's going to tell us about upcoming webinars that we have planned for next week.
We do not have a webinar next week, as most folks in the industry will be at Ocean Sciences. Our next webinar will be March 4th with Jeremy Mathis.
Great. So thank you all for your time today. I'm going to end the webinar now.
Thank you.
The organizer has ended the session, and this call will be disconnected.